Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us this morning. Barack Obama's very first formal television interview in the White House as president was with Al Arabiya. It's a satellite network that is aimed at the Arab world. And his choice in doing that makes it very clear both the importance of the relationship between the United States and the Muslim world and also the somewhat troubled history of that relationship. This morning, in this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with someone who has written and spoken widely on Muslim-Western relations, and he'll be sharing some of his thoughts with us this morning on what it will take to build greater understanding between those two worlds. His name is Anwar Majid, he is here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois from where he lives in New England. He is a professor and also founding chair of the Department of English at University of New England in Maine. He is author of a number of books, including one in which he makes some very interesting observations. This is a book that was published in 2007, the title A Call for Heresy, Why Dissent is Vital to Islam and America. He will be giving a talk at the Urbana Free Library tonight that's co-sponsored by the Center for South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at the university, also the Center for Global Studies, and the Illinois Network on Islam and Muslim Societies. This is free and open to the public. That's tonight at 7 o'clock at the library, talking about, I'm sure, some of the same ideas that we'll be talking about here this morning in the conversation. So certainly if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana, feel welcome to attend tonight at the library. And here on this program, feel welcome to call in with questions, comments. The number, as always, 333-9455. And we do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, feel free to give us a call. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
I guess I'm interested in your reaction just to start to that that little bit that I used to introduce the program, and that is the fact that President Obama, his very first formal interview, he chose to give to this network that was aimed at the Arab world. So obviously, very clear that he recognized that this was an important relationship and one that needed work.
Yes, I know that's a very good thing he did. It doesn't surprise me, and I think if I remember correctly, and I may be mistaken on this one, that even when he was president-elect and not before he was inaugurated, I think the first phone call he made was either to Mahmoud Abbas of the PLO or someone from the I'm not sure, but it was one of the early phone calls he made. And it reminded me of the significance of the American-Arab or Muslim relations throughout history. I mean, the Middle East has always occupied a very special place in the American imagination. People think it's a new issue, maybe related to the, you know, Israeli-Palestinian conflict or, you know, the controversies that has swollen in other parts of the Middle East. But the United States, since its inception, has always had a very strong interest in the Middle East, particularly because it's also the location of the Holy Land and other, you know, the American identity itself draws heavily from the mythologies and the scriptures of the Middle East. So, you know, it does, from a cultural point of view and a historical one, it doesn't surprise me that he made those phone calls, even though people tend to think of them in narrower terms, like particularly in relation to the, you know, Israeli and Palestinian conflict.
Yeah. And certainly, particularly now, since 9/11, we have talked about at great length the relationship and the tensions between the Islamic world, particularly the Arab Middle East and West Asia, and the United States and Western Europe. And another thing that in looking at your work and thinking about it, I found myself thinking was that indeed this kind of tension, if we look at the tension between the West with capital W and the Islamic world, that's not new. That just didn't come along after 9/11. And in fact, you look at the history of pre-modern Western Europe, there was a little thing called the Crusades. Mm-hmm. So those kinds of tensions do go back a long way.
Yes, I do. They do. And this is probably the right time for me to make a plug-in for another talk I'm giving this afternoon.
Yes.
At 4 p.m. I think it's sponsored by the Global Studies Program. It's called The Muslim Within. and basically, you know, the Islamic, you know, the Islamic elements in Western identity that are very hidden. People are not very conscious of. So it'll be, I'll be showing some pictures and some slides and talking about, particularly about the case of Spain. And yet, absolutely, and the part of what I'll be talking about is that you cannot you cannot conceive of Europe, European identity or Western identity without Islam. Mm-hmm. Islam is the other side. It's what makes European identity possible. It's what makes Western, the notion of the West possible. In fact, the Crusades are what gave some Christian identity, what associated Europe with Christianity. And it's always in relation to Islam. Islam has had a long-standing role of consolidating Christian European identity, and in the secular age, the notion of the West as a unified cultural whole, although it's split in so many different ways. It's never as cohesive as people want it to be. But Islam plays that function, has always played that historical function. It allows the West to see itself as one, or Europe to see itself as one. Whereas, the relationships between Europe and the West and Islam, or within the European or Western body, are much more complicated than people think.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also it makes me think about the fact that now, also I think particularly within the last few years, there has been greater acknowledgement of the impact of the Islamic world and art, literature, science, architecture, all of that, the impact that it had had on Western Europe. And certainly people would make the argument that says we should not be talking about a Judeo-Christian tradition. We should be talking about the Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition, because it is one tradition and you cannot separate out the cultural influences. And yet somehow we have a difficult time getting that third piece in there and adding that in and seeing that as one thing.
That's right. And then the emergence of a Judeo-Christian tradition is relatively new. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't make a lot of sense to a lot of people. But many Jews are not comfortable with that kind of combination. Because for much of Christian history, Judaism was as much of an undesirable religion as Islam was. In fact, the two, the Jews and the Muslims, were very often seen as one and the same, allies against, you know, the Christian, Christian culture and so on and so forth, faith. So I think adding a religion onto the Abrahamic faith, so to speak, if you added Islam to that duo, it would be a nice gesture. It's a gesture of inclusion. But I'm not so sure it's going to do a tremendous lot in changing people's perceptions and so on, or educating people about the real differences and also what's similar among all the three faiths. What's the question again?
How it is that there are commonalities there are connections there, and that they're important, but that there are things that we maybe only recently and incompletely have begun to acknowledge.
It reminds me of something I heard a year ago or so in relation to how the United States or how Americans get to know the world. You know, somebody said, I can't remember the source of it, they said, you know, you have to declare war on someone to know their culture. And that's very interesting. But there is something to this. It's more than, there's something to this. There's some element, whenever acts of violence, or when you're fighting someone, or when you declare war on someone, suddenly the culture of the enemy becomes much more significant and much more important to you, or to the side fighting it. So in a very interesting way, even though Islam is increasingly seen as an unreasonable culture and dangerous and full of terrorists and so on and so forth, and at the same time, there's growing interest in Islamic culture and Islamic civilization and so on. Mm-hmm. Remember, it began with the Crusades. In the Crusades, you know, the Crusaders came back with a lot of new cultural discoveries, and which played a significant role in creating a better European culture and a more refined civilization in Europe. Mm-hmm. So wars do have that effect, ironically and paradoxically.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Anwar Majid. He is the professor and founding chair of the Department of English at University of New England, that's in Maine, and is someone who has done a lot of writing and speaking about Islam and the development of Islam and Islamic culture and relations between the West and the Islamic world. One book in particular, a recent one that lays out some very interesting ideas you might want to look at, is his book. It's titled A Call for Heresy, Why Dissent is Vital to Islam and America. He's here visiting in our area. He'll be giving a talk. One, again, I want to mention that is the one that's tonight at the Urbana Free Library, 7 o'clock. It's open to anybody who would like to attend. And, of course, questions and comments are welcome to 333-9455 and toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone here on our line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. I would like to tell the gentleman that I called the Jewish temple here, and their education director told me that 90% of Israel is secular. She said they don't even believe in God or an afterlife. And I wondered if he was aware of this. I don't think most Americans are. And if he would comment on, because this is really, you know, they talk so much about their Jewish history, but if they're secular, you know, that should make a real difference. Does he know anything about this?
Well, you respond to that however you would like.
Sure. I mean, yeah. I mean, fine. I mean, yeah. I mean, I don't know much. I'm not an expert on Israeli history and Israeli society, but my assumption, it makes sense to me to be secular. And, yeah, so.
I guess that's about the best response we can give you.
Yeah.
Oh, you don't know anything further.
Well, it's not particularly his area of expertise.
Oh, well, I would say. Oh, so he's not a Middle East historian.
No, I'm not a specialist in Middle Eastern history.
Oh,
but,
okay. You're just mainly the Muslim history.
Not even that. So, I mean, I'm talking about Islam and West relations, and yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think if more Americans were aware that Israel is secular, it would make a real difference in our attitude toward Israel.
All right. Well, mm-hmm. I appreciate the comment.
Yeah. Let's
talk with someone else here, someone in Effingham. This is our line number four, our toll-free line. Hello.
Thank you. Well, I hope my question is not out of line either of the expertise of your guest, but the Middle East and Westerners and Constantine, do you have any knowledge of those events after 370, I think it was, or along there a few years one way or the other, that Constantine moved the Roman Empire and founded Constantinople? And which was, 300 years before Muhammad came along, and then he invited the Western Europeans and the local Arabic peoples, you know, which were far older than the Roman Empire. And do you have, you know, the effects of what happened there, and the incubus of the practices of Western civilization upon the Eastern world, is that pertinent to do? The events we have now point clear back to those days when the Arabic nations, which were some thousands of years older than the Romans and even the Greeks, but is that too far out of line, David?
Well, I don't know. You can respond to that if you can.
The only thing I can see that's related to some of the things I do is when Constantine put together a church, a Catholic church, so to speak, and unified and tried to create one body out of the disparate Christian beliefs that were circulating throughout the Middle East. Now that we've recently been discovering some of them, like the Gnostics in Egypt and so on and so forth, I mean, he created, in effect, a superstructure of Christianity, which and made the church sort of orthodox. and thereby decreed anybody who stood outside the confines of the parameters of this church that he established to be a heretic, which is something I deal with in the book that was you mentioned that was published in 2007. So religions have a way all religions have a way of consolidating, of trying to create the parameters of the faith, who is included and who is excluded, and thereby, you know, put a tremendous amount of pressure on people who have different perspectives, different attitudes, different belief systems, or different narratives about their faith. And it's very interesting to keep that in mind as we reflect on questions of identity or who is a Muslim and not a Muslim today, and the same applies to other religions as well.
Just to maybe that gives me an opportunity to ask you to talk a little bit about the way that you think about the word heretic, which comes up in this book. And it's my understanding that what you're talking about is that for you, heretic is perhaps synonymous with another word like revolutionary. That and what you're one of the things that you're arguing is that nations, movements, perhaps also religions, need people who will challenge the prevailing viewpoint. People who are going to, in a sense, to use the phrase, push the envelope. You know, people who are always going to be agitating and questioning common beliefs, and that is something that you would say that any society or any group of people. We need people like this.
Absolutely. They're as vital to the functioning of a society or community or any institution than as the others who are other members of the community. But they play a critical function because ideas have a tendency to ossify over time. You know, the church, I mean, and people need structures. In the case of Constantine and the church, people need parameters of the faith, parameters of ideology. What is a nation? What is a national identity, for example, and so on. So they have to create, and they very often invent it for the sake of convenience. But they don't have to make absolute sense. Rarely do they make rational sense. So what you have then is as systems begin to develop and become consolidated over time, whether they're religious or political or economic systems. And in all of my work, I always pay a significant amount of attention to the economic side of things. And I talk about we need a lot of economic heretics, people who can think outside of the box, people who think differently. Because if you looked carefully in the last few decades, anybody who cared to look at the economic situation or superstructure in the United States and globally, it didn't make much sense. You know, you could see the cracks, you could see the tensions, you could see the irrational system operating and affecting people in very bad ways. And only now do we see that it's a structure that was that it didn't have solid feet. If we listened, if the establishment had listened to the voices of heretics, people who were criticizing the system and not dismissed them as anti-capitalist or anti- or like pseudo-socialist or some such other designation, I think we would have been better off. And we may have had a chance to work out the problems and see them for what they were and not wait till the crisis hits us. The same thing happens in religion, the political ideologies and so forth and so forth. So heretics are the voice and the voices of dissent are there to remind us that there are problems that need to be addressed, that there are areas that we haven't paid attention to, and it's a good thing intellectually and culturally to heed these voices.
We have some other callers, some people who are in Champaign listening to us this morning. Let's go to line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in his lecture at 4 o'clock. Is that at the Levis Center? Is that, you know, MillerCom, or what is that? Could you find out?
No, we can find out. I don't have that. We don't have that information right in front of us, but we can find out.
Yeah,
for you.
Yeah.
Okay, that's it.
All right, well, let's go on to another caller here. This is line number two and also someone in Champaign. Hello.
Yes, I'm a historian of religions, but I don't study the Middle East and the Middle Eastern religions in particular. But one thing I do recall when I was in graduate school on the East Coast that one of my professors, when someone mentioned the Judeo-Christian religion, used this phrase, he said, well, that doesn't exist. he said that is a contemporary usage that's used by Christians in order to erase Judaic traditions in particular. But I think it's a very complex issue. But I do think it's very important to keep in mind, on the one hand, the connections between these traditions, as well as, of course, their distinctions historically. Just one thing I think I find interesting about this, one of the great problems in the West, and I think this is related to what you're focusing on, is on the one hand, especially at the state and I suppose intellectual classes level, Orientalism as a kind of founding something that's fundamentally related to modernity, and of course the creation of the modern nation state. That sort of political level, and of course by extension cultural level, at the same time with the development of modernity, there was fundamentalism. And that what we think of as being fundamentalism in the States, for example, is something fairly new, right? The 1880s onwards, most of these movements started, and they'll all tell you they go back to the Bible in Christian circles, but the very recent developments, and Islamic fundamentalism, too, is pretty recent, right? 20th century, really. And that these, we often note that these are largely responses to modernity, that there are different classes of people, often not of the intellectual classes, who are trying to respond to a new situation, right? How do they situate their own identity in this difficult age? And they'll latch on, for a variety of reasons, for better or worse, to a way of life that they identify as being ancient, but in fact is quite new. So I'm just curious whether you speak to that in your research, or you're interested, or you see that aspect in the Western case, that we demonize Islam, for example, but that's a process of scapegoating, perhaps also related to Orientalism and perhaps fundamentalism.
Well, it's a big question, and you're a historian, so I'll do my best to give you a concise answer to see if I can put together some of the ideas and see if I can address them collectively. One, there's absolutely no doubt that Europe and before the West was created, as you know, have always had a fascination with the East, with Islam. Well, before Islam, it was the East, and after Islam, Islam was part of the East. Which Orientalism then has a very old pedigree in European thought and culture.
Yeah,
I mean, and so the notion. And that's even people who describe themselves as Judeo-Christian in the United States today, they're in fact assuming a Middle Eastern identity, because Christianity and Islam and Judaism, all of them were created in the Middle East.
Right.
So in the foundation of the American Christian movement is in some ways Middle Eastern. And that's very interesting to me to watch, because, you know, so the Orient is always part of the West. It's always been part of the West in so many ways. And the fascination has always been there since time immemorial, since ancient Greece and onwards. The other thing is the development of the nation state. And maybe I should mention something I'll be talking about this afternoon and a book that's coming out in April. The nation state, in my view, emerged in Spain in 1492.
Uh-huh.
And because it was the first time a nation was unified itself, used religion as an excuse to create a national identity, and also created a national language, a Castilian language, and therefore obscuring some other regional languages there. And it was the first year, 1492 also is the year when the Americas, of course, were discovered, and Christopher Columbus was dispatched across the Atlantic Ocean to on his mission. So, but the Moors, who were defeated finally, the last bastion of Moorish culture, Granada, in 1492 was defeated. It played a significant role in unifying the Iberian Peninsula. It has never been fully unified, as you know. The Basque region, Catalonia, and so on still have their independence movements and autonomies. But it created, for the first time, we begin to see the emergence of a modern nation state with a language and religion and so on. And therefore, a nation state also needs its minorities. A nation cannot have a national identity without minorities, because the minorities are there to remind you that there is, in fact, a national identity. And so the Moors and the Muslims became the paradigmatic figures, the archetype of all minorities in the West since then. And that's the subject of my book coming out in April, and I I'm very excited about it. So
it's very interesting. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you. Well, we are about on our midpoint here. Let me introduce again our guest for anyone who might have tuned in the last 10 or 15 minutes. We're talking this morning with Anwar Majid. He is the founding chair and professor of English at the University of New England, that's in Maine, and has written a good deal about the history of Islam and about the relationship between Islam and the West. Among his books, this one that I've mentioned, A Call for Heresy, Why Dissent is Vital to Islam and America, published by the University of Minnesota Press in 2007. And some others. So if you're interested in reading some of his other work, you can look for it, including the book that will be coming out soon that he just talked about. And if you are in Champaign-Urbana, in our area here, there are two opportunities for you to hear more from him. He will be giving a talk on the topic, The Muslim Within, Reflections on the Islamic Dimension of Western Identity. That's this afternoon at 4 o'clock. This will be on the U of I campus in room 213 of Gregory Hall. And then tonight, he also will be speaking at the Urbana Free Library, talking more on some of the kind of things that we're talking about here this morning. And that talk is at 7 o'clock, the Urbana Free Library. It is free and open to anybody who would like to attend. So if you'd like to hear more from him, feel free to stop by the library tonight. And, of course, here on the program, questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. One other thing, one other sort of area that I'm interested in and having you talk about, I know that we've talked a couple of times about the book, about The Call for Heresy, and that it was my understanding that you wanted to write a book about, or were even thinking about titling it something to the effect of, let me see, and I haven't known that, Why America Matters. And part of what your interest was is to try to explain America to the particularly to the Arabic Muslim world, because you felt that the United States had done actually a very poor job. We even had people who were given, you know, since 9/11, we actually had people who were given that responsibility, that somehow they were supposed to sell America to the Arab world. Well, I think your feeling was, and I think a lot of other people's feeling is, that we hadn't done a very good job at doing that. What is it that you would think that you would like people in that part of the world to know about the United States?
Well, the election of Obama is an interesting event. Mm-hmm. I mean, it embodies everything that I've been trying to explain to people. Prior to that event, that the United States, the founding documents of the United States, whether the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution, and the variety and the American literary and cultural traditions, as well as its history, of which always maintained a healthy tension between the secular and the religious. And has always been part of the American fabric. It's is something that the Muslims ought to study and study very carefully, because here we have a nation of very devout and religious people in so many ways. I mean, parts, big chunks of the United States, of people are quite religious, probably much more religious than one of the last callers said in Israel. Any other Western democracy. But at the same time, there are strong measures in place, secular measures in place, whether it's constitutional, you know, and so on, and other laws, that guarantee everybody's freedom to religion or religious belief or non-belief if they wanted to. It is this tension that runs through American history, in addition to the robust democratic voices that have emerged periodically and consistently throughout much of American history, that is completely obscured, that's almost non-existent in the Islamic, when Muslims, in the Islamic imagination today. So we want, I mean, I do want the Arabs and the Muslims and other members of the global community to understand the richness and the diversity and the tensions that have informed and consistently revitalized, you know, the conception and the founding ideas of the American Republic.
Yeah. I just last night happened to sit down and watch the interview that you did with Bill Moyers, where you were on his program and you were talking about some of these things. And you made what I thought was a very interesting observation, that perhaps one of the things that it would be good for people in the Islamic world to understand is that the kind of issues that they are struggling with, trying to sort out the relationship between secular and sacred, between those two sets of values, although I suppose some people in the Islamic world would say, no, there's only one. There is no such division. It's all one. And there are some Americans who would say, yes, we agree with that. It is all one. But having said that, I think a lot of people here in this country are struggling to try to negotiate this relationship between these two spheres and how they should come together. You know, should they come together? How should they come together? Should they be separate? And that it would be a good thing for people in the Islamic world to understand that here in the United States, even now today, we are struggling with those same things. And that is, in fact, something, you know, the business of trying to figure that out is something that we have in common.
That, absolutely. And I think, you know, much, you know, in this case, the United States is more instructive to Muslims trying to conceive or formulate some kind of democratic modus operandi in their societies than Europe is, because Europe has at least parts of Europe, like France and so on, have an anti-clerical tradition, and that the revolution is primarily an anti-clerical one. But in the United States, it was a very interesting, very clever, very pragmatic negotiation of the sacred and the secular, even though some of the founding fathers like Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin were probably deist, if not secret atheists. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, they recognize the social force of religion, and religion rarely goes away in many of these societies. So, how does one work with religions and systems of piety and the sacred is a big challenge to any society that's trying to establish a democracy and promote a culture of freedom that does not discriminate against any of its members. And I think one of the in my estimation, one of the failings, but now I'm not so sure, one of the failings in Iraq was the constitutional model that was presented to both Iraq and Afghanistan was not modeled on the United States Constitution, because they made Islam the religion, they maintained the notion of Islam as a religion of state, and thereby implicitly discriminated against the non-Muslims in those societies. And a non-Muslim cannot become president in any of these two nations, given the language in these constitutions, and I think, you know, the consultants in this case said, well, that's the best we can do in both societies. I think Muslims and these societies could do better, but I'm also heartened by the fact that in the latest elections in Iraq, you know, the so quote unquote secular government of Maliki seems to making some headway.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk with some of the folks here. Okay. Let's go to another Champagne caller. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I wanted to pick up on the matter of the establishment of the modern state that you talked about in terms of Spain in 1492. It's interesting that, I mean, you brought up the issue with the Moors, and I wanted to bring up there's another issue in a sense that the state was based on a certain amount of call it blood purity issues, especially related to the Inquisition and the Jews, who were either forced to convert or forced the expulsion of the Jews from Spain. And the fact that for at least a century afterwards, there were issues of race that were related to being Spanish or not being Spanish in terms of what was known as conversos, in other words, Jews who were known as the new Christians who had baptized and become Christians in order not to leave Spain. And this became a whole issue of state. What's particularly interesting, I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but there's a historian, Ben-Zion Netanyahu, who was the father of actually the politician in Israel now, who wrote a book called The Origins of the Inquisition in 15th Century Spain, which is quite well known and I think highly thought of by historians. Are you familiar with that?
I am familiar with it, yeah, but I haven't read that particular book. I read by another historian of the Inquisition. His name is Josef Perez. Uh-huh. So, but whatever. Yeah, go ahead.
So I just wondered because I wondered whether you were familiar with that aspect of the,
yes.
What should I say, the racist aspect.
That's right.
Of, the development of state in Spain during that period.
Absolutely. And I don't want to be talking about my next book, but I do spend a good amount of time talking about this episode in Spanish history. You know, you're talking about Limpieza de Sangre, which is the purity of blood statute that was promulgated in the 15th century, which in effect, initially was opposed by the Pope because it went against the Christian imperative of conversion. So how could you, by injecting race into faith? The process of conversion became extremely difficult, if not impossible. And only in the 16th century, in the middle of the 1500s, did the Pope go along with the Spanish authorities and accept this very interesting law. And that, which in effect kept discriminating against the conversos, you mentioned. You talked about the people who have either Jews or Muslims who converted to the Catholic faith, but they were not purely 100% Catholic because they were genealogically tainted. And they remained tainted. That law remained in effect until the 19th century. That's an amazing case of how race and faith were blended for the first time in such manner in history. And in many ways, interesting ways that it's a precursor of what would happen in the 20th century with the horrors of Nazi Germany and so on and so forth. So the origins of a lot of the worst atrocities of the 20th century, particularly when it comes to race, may very well be traced to this very interesting episode in Spanish history. You're right.
Yeah, the race laws of Nazi Germany have actually been traced and linked to these race laws in Spain, which, mm-hmm. as you say, had continued to exist for centuries, almost as a relic, but were used in a literal way, and in some ways were reinforced even by the Franco regime, even though they had different legal basis.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Again, let's go on to another caller. This is someone in Urbana and line two. Hello.
Hello. I'm rather interested in this aspect of the question in Spain because I'm not sure that it's really definable as race, because having expelled the largest percentage of the Jewish population and most of the Islamic population, they then were underpopulated and imported large numbers of sub-Saharan Africans as slaves, but still brought them into the gene pool.
Oh. Yeah, some of the slaves ended up here in the American continent. Actually, interestingly enough, there's some of those slaves that were brought into some sub-Saharan slaves that you mentioned were actually Muslims, and they had to convert before they were accepted and so on. That's another part of the interesting Spanish history, particularly in its relation to the New World. But
No, this was in Spain itself.
Okay, well, yeah. Yeah.
So it seems to me it's not clearly racial, but very clearly religious.
That's right.
Although it certainly became racial in the Nazi context.
Absolutely. The notion of race in Spain in the 15th and 16th centuries was not the same as the notion of race in the 19th and 20th century Europe.
That was part of what I wanted to get to.
Absolutely, because the modern form of racism has much more of a biological dimension to it. Although, the question of race in Spain, though, does, the notion of blood, to the extent that blood is associated with something that you cannot get rid of, and which is the basis of all genealogies and so on and so forth, they injected an element. Again, this statute of purity of blood statute of Limpieza de Sangre added another dimension to the question of faith. And so what happens then when you try to convert people, the people who have been originally Jewish or Muslim, into the Christian faith, and that at the same time telling them that they are genealogically incapable of being true Christians? And that is the you could see echoes there, as one of the callers mentioned, echoes of what would happen later in the 20th century, but not they're not exactly the same, you're right. Mm.
We have about 10 minutes left. You can see our listeners have very wide-ranging interests. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Anwar Majid. He is a professor, founding chair, Department of English at University of New England. That's in Maine. He's here visiting the campus. We'll be giving a couple of talks. He's written a lot, does a lot of talking about the development of Islam, Islamic culture, and relations between the West, Western Europe and the Islamic world. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Something that I'd like to kind of get back to, and I guess it does have something to do with the balance between the secular. The sacred and the secular, and that here in the United States we like to believe, we talk about the need for there being a separation, although, as I said, there are some people who would say, well, they believe that their religious values inform everything that they do, and that they would certainly say that they feel that they have every right and a duty to be involved in the public sphere. It seems to me, and you can tell me if this is correct, that for many Muslims, they simply don't see that separation. They would say, yes, in fact, their faith does inform everything that they do and their involvement in the public sphere, and that they think that it's very important that their religious values be incorporated into their political values, that they just don't make that separation that we make. Mm-hmm. Does that somehow make things more complicated as we and they try to relate?
Yeah, it does. Interestingly enough, Alexis de Tocqueville, you know, the famous commentator on American democracy, in his book Democracy in America, at one point was talking about the prospects of American democracy. Says this model it cannot be reproduced blindly anywhere. You know, this is almost specific to the United States, but certainly not in the Islamic world. You know, he has a passage there that in Islamic cultures, Islam, you know, the Quran is the act as the overall constitution. It pays attention to small details and stuff like that. So it leaves very little room, very little leeway, very little maneuvering to create other secular, non-religious alternatives, you know, of social organization, of political life, and so on. And that is a very interesting case, particularly in the recent events in Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, how does one create a democratic structure or constitution that provides equal rights to everybody, and yet at the same time still be somehow linked to the supremacy of Islam as a state religion or as the common faith of the people, and so on and so forth? It is something to wrestle with, and it may entail calling for revising religion itself, or the notion of religion, or religiosity, or the ways people perceive their own faith, or the faith, or the history of their own faith, even including the most sacred documents in this faith, in a different manner.
Mm. We're coming to the point here where we may have about 5 minutes left, and I want to at least raise another issue. This is complicated. I'm sure we could talk about it for a long time, but it goes back to the now well-known clash of civilizations kind of conversation that's been going on again since 9/11, and I found myself thinking about that as well, in the sense that it some people, I think, represent this clash as being something that is fundamentally a clash over, perhaps over culture, cultural values, particularly over religious values. And I wonder whether, in fact, that understates the extent to which this, if there is a clash here, it is a political clash, a political struggle, and that nationalism, particularly Arab nationalism, has a strong role to play here. And I'm not sure that we have really acknowledged that.
Well, these are very interesting questions. I mean, the question to ask all the time at any given moment is, does the political couch itself in the religious, or is it vice versa? I'm not sure. I mean, I think usually religion in so many ways acts as an ideology. as a motivational tool. You know, people have political issues or very mundane issues or disagreements or quarrels, and they bring religion into it. And there to provide a sense of solidarity, to create an excitement, to bring even more momentum and maybe even boost morale of the parties that are quarreling or fighting or whatever. So I am not so sure what comes first. In the history of humanity, I think quarrels are inevitable. Political quarrels are inevitable, but they always get phrased. They're always given some transcendental meaning. It's either God or freedom or democracy or human rights. Any ideology, any beautiful idea deployed for the cause of war or oppression or anything else, it's kind of, to me, it's questionable. Mm. That's why the heretics again, that's why we need those heretics who keep reminding us that these ideas have to be scrutinized. Anytime we deploy faith or politics or ideology in the name of some form of aggression or exploitation, we need to be careful. We need to be wary of those.
Yeah. To come around to where we started at, and talked at the beginning about the fact that that President Obama has made it clear that in the foreign policy arena, he's very concerned about relations between the United States and the Muslim world, particularly we have to acknowledge that the Muslim world is very big. So particularly here, our focus has been, the Middle East, West Asia and North Africa. But that it seems very clear that he thinks this is a relationship that needs to be addressed and has talked about the fact that we're interested in reaching out if they will reach out, and that we're interested in having a relationship that's based on mutual respect and mutual interest. I guess the question is, going beyond saying that, what actually has to happen or what could happen? What could we do, at least on our side of this, to try to bring that along?
I think we should take some of President Obama's approach to the Middle East, or basically his philosophy as a whole, and turn it into a doctrine. And let's call it the doctrine of conversation. Mm-hmm. Obama's doctrine of conversation. I really genuinely believe that conversation is one of the most revolutionary and most powerful instruments at our disposal to undo a lot of the damage that is being created daily across the globe. And the interesting thing about conversations and the beautiful thing about conversations is they don't end. They're not supposed to end. You could carry on a conversation indefinitely. And the goal of a conversation is not to reach some kind of exclusive truth, one party to reach a truth at the expense of the other one, but to continuously engage, to be engaged in this conversation, not for the sake of an ultimate truth, a supreme truth that beats all other truths, but to maintain a healthy relationship with your interlocutor, with the person you're speaking to. And that's how you get to know people. Mm-hmm. So it's any time you use the language of conversation, you propose a conversation to somebody else, you're inviting them to the table to converse. You are not doing that to, I hope you're not doing that to show that you are better than them or that your argument is stronger than theirs and so on and so forth, but to keep them talking. Keep people talking. As long as people are talking together, nations, people, communities, the likelihood of violence or the possible, is diminished. And the likelihood of trust gets boosted and increased. So there's a tremendous advantage to conversation. And unlike, I really do hope it's followed with as much vigor and determination as other people have followed different kinds of policies.
Yeah. Well, doesn't have to be a conversation that begins at least for its own sake, that it's not a conversation, it's not a negotiation, it's conversation that happens where, in a sense, nothing is, there's no purpose other than to have, in a sense, there's no purpose other than to have the conversation.
Yes. I think, once, if you approach it strategically from a political point of view, you're already giving it a utilitarian cast. You should approach a conversation as a way of knowing somebody else, as a way of knowing your enemy, Very often the enemy is us, you know. Very often the enemy is in us. So it is a way to come to know the human dimensions of the other side. And for the other side, if we tried this across the board, whether it's in regional conflicts or larger ones or communal ones, I think there's a possibility of doing better. Because nations, you cannot take the pride out of people. You cannot. People are very committed to their ideals and memories and histories and so on. So conversation may be an alternative, maybe a heretical way of doing things in the global environment.
Our guest, Anwar Masjid, is a professor and founding chair of the Department of English at University of New England. That's in Biddeford, Maine. He's here visiting the campus. We'll give two talks. Let me again mention those. The Muslim Within, Reflections on the Islamic Dimensions of Western Identity. That's this afternoon, 4 o'clock in room 213 of Gregory Hall. That's on the U of I campus. And then he'll be talking about The Power of Heresy tonight at 7. That's at the Urbana Free Library. This is co-sponsored by the Center for South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies, the Center for Global Studies, and the Illinois Network on Islam and Muslim Societies. It's free, open to the public. Anybody who is interested can attend. And also, if you'd like to read some over his thoughts, you might look at this book that we mentioned a couple of times, A Call for Heresy, Why Dissent is Vital to Islam and America, published by University of Minnesota Press. It came out in year 2007. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.